Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. Citizens in Peru and Chile have recently voted for major change. Will Colombia be the next to join the club?
People want change. But one thing is change, and another thing is to say we need to restart from zero. We need to basically ignore everything that's done in the past. Not everything is lost.
People all over the Americas today seem eager for change, but you could argue that nobody wants change more than people in Colombia right now. In a global poll taken in August by Ipsos, 88% of Colombians said they believe their country was on the wrong track. That was more than any of the other 27 countries Ipsos surveyed. Turkey, South Africa, and Peru were also in the 80s. The global average was just 64%. This pessimism, this unrest with the status quo, is related, of course, to the pandemic, but also Colombia's chronic double-digit unemployment, some of Latin America's worst inequality, as well as the violence and social unrest we've seen in recent years. It's the backdrop for presidential elections taking place in Colombia in May 2022, in which the anti-establishment leftist Gustavo Petro is currently leading polls, albeit in a very fragmented field. So, is Colombia about to embark on a period of radical change? Is the pessimism most Colombians feel justified or exaggerated? Is there a path for less radical candidates in next year's race? And what are the lessons of Colombia's recent experiences for the rest of the region? Our guest today is my friend Mauricio Cárdenas. Mauricio was the finance minister of Colombia from 2012 to 2018 under President Juan Manuel Santos. He's now at Columbia University, a regular contributor to America's Quarterly, and one of two dozen or so precandidatos exploring potential presidential bids in 2022. Most recently, he is the author of Cómo Avanza Colombia, a book that details areas where the country has actually made progress in recent years, such as infrastructure and reducing tax evasion. Mauricio, thank you so much for joining us today on the AQ podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Brian.
Now, Mauricio, I just want to say this book does not read like sort of your typical memoir by somebody who might be making a presidential bid. Not at all. It's much more consistent with your work as a public intellectual over the years. Tell me, though, I mean, why at a moment of such intense pessimism, why did you try to write a book arguing that there are reasons to be proud of Colombia's recent record? What's the argument for Colombians to not jump into the void, which is a phrase that you use in the book?
It was my way of dealing with so much negative things going on around. It was also my way of responding to calls for kind of like reset of the system, that we have to change everything, that we have to start from scratch. And I think progress is not that. I think progress is learning from our own past mistakes and failures, and learning on how we overcame them and what are the ingredients in order to transform failure into progress. So I thought about topics where I could provide good examples of that.
Now, the book is not an argument for the status quo. It is instead a celebration of things that have gone right in recent years, as you said. But inevitably, and I see this sometimes with things that we publish at America's Quarterly, we live in a world right now where any argument that, you know, essentially says, hey, maybe some things are not worth throwing out, those arguments face a lot of skepticism and even eye rolling in some cases. What is the reaction to the book been so far?
Well, it just was launched, so it's very recent. And I'm getting messages from a number of people, others that are in the political field, saying, well, this is good because it balances the conversation. So going back to your introduction, I think there is a need for change. Definitely people want change. But one thing is change. And another thing is to say we need to restart from zero. We need to basically ignore everything that's done in the past. not everything is lost. There are a number of things that we can build on. So my call is for reform, change, but in a smart way, informed way, with evidence, and looking at what has worked in Colombia or in other parts of the world and applying those lessons to us.
Let's do a little x-ray of Colombia here and talk about kind of the key statistics right now. Nearly a third of the country is fully vaccinated. That's a bit below the Latin American average. While COVID cases have leveled off after peaking in late June, the mass protests that we saw earlier this year have dissipated. Schools have finally reopened following one of the longest closures in Latin America. GDP growth this year is expected to run about 5.1%, which would come just shy of recouping the losses suffered in the 2020 contraction. Some of those stats are good, right? But then there's the other side, which is there's a crisis of unemployment with over 14% of adult Colombians out of work, according to the most recent figures. We've also seen a near doubling of so-called masacres, these mass killings that have been reported by the defense ministry, issues with corruption and so on. How do you explain this malaise that seems to have taken hold of Colombia in recent years, this pessimism? I mean, do the statistics that I just quoted explain some of it, or is there something else going on?
So beyond the statistics, Brian, there is an emotion, there is a sentiment of failure, that things are not moving well, that the country is not progressing. And I think COVID and the effects of the pandemic have made that a lot worse. Although you could look at the statistics and say, well, the economy is recovering, new jobs are being generated, we're still, you know, far, far behind where we were a few years ago. And people in the streets in Colombia are now seeing that the system has not delivered. So that's when caudillos arise, caudillos that provide simple answers and that also suggest simple solutions. But that will only come, I think, with a cost. And the cost is unfulfilled expectations, bad decisions. And who knows, maybe the pandemic is just the introduction, the prologue to a more prolonged and deeper crisis. So my book should be read as trying to avoid that, trying to say, look, yes, there's pessimism, but there's a way out. And the way out is with a combination of ingredients that involves also learning from our past and learning from things that we have done well.
Well, I want to talk about the potential caudillos in 2022's election in a moment. But before we do, I think it's important for you to highlight one or two examples of these areas that you believe really did represent progress in recent years and provide the foundation for now moving forward. I mean, what are one or two examples of these chapters in your book and what they look at?
Well, these chapters are a little bit like elaborations of a theory of change. How have we changed? How have we turned from failure to success? Infrastructure, it was repeated that our infrastructure was a failure, that we didn't have the roads, that this was a legacy of the colonial times and an emblematic expression of the ineffectiveness of the state in Colombia. And that was true. Now we have a system that is working. Now we're building more roads than any other country in Latin America. So why was that? Why we were able to turn a failed model into a success story? So that's one chapter. It's about a combination of forces that finally made Colombia a success story. If I'm allowed to, I'll give you an example, which is kind of like a great illustration of why this is something that is changing. Colombia is crossed from south to north by the Magdalena River. Now, the Magdalena River divides the country in two, east and west. Prior to 2014, only 7 years ago, there were only 11 crossings in the Magdalena River, 11 bridges. In 200s of history, 11 bridges. Now, since 2014 until today, there are 10 new bridges. So we almost doubled in 7 years what we had done in two centuries. That just shows how things have changed for the better.
Mauricio, a quote that struck me in the book was, you wrote, "The world lives in a permanent contradiction. We value little that which is the most important." Can you explain what you meant by that?
That's a chapter where I talk about the three greatest challenges of Colombia, of today and Colombia of the future, which is health, the pandemic. I wrote this during the pandemic, drug trafficking, and climate change. And I think the three have something in common, which is the market puts a price on health, on carbon emissions, on drugs, which is very different from the real value. Let me give you examples. We have land that is full of tropical forests, which is crucial as a carbon sink. And it's crucial for the world as a carbon sink. Well, the price of an acre of land full of tropical forests is much lower than the price of an acre of land that has been deforested and that is ready for cattle. So the price is saying something very different from the value for us as a society. The price that some consumers pay for their cocaine in the world markets is much less than the cost for a country like Colombia. So if they were going to pay the real value of that, they'll have to pay a much higher price because it's destroying our environment, our biodiversity, is generating corruption in Colombia, is destroying our judiciary system. It's causing a lot of problems. I'd say something else. I think drug trafficking has made our society even more unequal. So anyway, prices are not necessarily telling us everything about value, the value of things. So we have to move into a way of putting a price that corresponds more to the real value.
Mauricio, you just mentioned inequality, and in many respects, all over the Americas, including here in the United States, but also in Chile, in Brazil, inequality had already been rising prior to the pandemic. It increased at vertiginous rates because of the effects of the pandemic. It was at the heart of protests in Chile, in Colombia as well. And I'm wondering, I mean, for those who say, look, this is not a short-term issue. And yes, it's great that we have more bridges than we did before, and that's very important. But this long record that led us to today, where Colombia has, even by Latin American standards, a very, very high Gini coefficient, which I'm sure our listeners know is the main number used to assess inequality in society. You know, people will say this points to the need to really think differently and engage in some radical change. What's your response on that issue specifically?
Look, the state is the one that has to play a very important role in bridging differences, in reducing gaps. For the state to do that, the state needs capacities. You have to build those capacities. And one of those capacities is to be able to tax and to tax the rich and to basically curb and control tax evasion. So I spent a good couple of chapters of the book discussing the progress that we have made in reducing tax evasion. One of those elements has been, for example, to criminalize tax evasion. Tax evasion was not a crime in Colombia until my time as Minister of Finance. It was heavily opposed by the elites. Colombia did not share information, or other countries did not share information with Colombia on the assets held by Colombians abroad.
Do you think ultimately, though, that the size of the Colombian state needs to increase? Because it's true. I mean, I remember following that whole, all the things that you did to reduce tax evasion while you were as finance minister and getting assailed from both the left and right. But, you know, in 2019, according to the OECD, the tax take in Colombia was equivalent of, it was 19.7% of GDP, which is still below the Latin American average at 22.9. Countries like, I mean, Brazil is at the very high end at 33, Argentina's at 28. I mean, where do you think Colombia needs to be in that panorama? Do you think there is a case still for a substantial increase in the size and scope of the Colombian state?
Absolutely, yes. Here's the problem. The state is actually not helping to reduce inequality. So if you have a state in a society that is as unequal as Colombia, the state should be playing a more active role. it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to raise tax rates. Tax rates are already quite high in Colombia. The VAT or personal income taxes or corporate taxes are relatively high. So the issue is that we have high tax rates, but low tax revenues. So the issue is evasion, dealing with evasion. So I think that's kind of like the number one priority. And second, expenditures are not as well targeted as they should be. So the pandemic should be a good opportunity to revise a number of government expenditures that are not playing their part in terms of reducing inequality. So we should discontinue some programs that do not have that type of impact and emphasize others that have been introduced before the pandemic, during the pandemic, that are much more progressive. But this is about reform. This is about, you know, changing policies. This is about learning from mistakes. This is about being able to introduce initiatives to Congress, spend political capital, use evidence, show to people why something has to be discontinued and why something else has to be expanded. And this is pretty much my approach.
Mauricio, you have made a very compelling case here for pragmatism, for moderation. Those things don't make great political slogans. They don't make great bumper stickers. They don't make great memes, especially in today's times. I am somebody who thinks about political language all the time, so maybe I'm too focused on this. But do you have any idea how to sell this agenda in terms of like how you describe it, whether it's, you know, whoever the candidate is who ends up being the standard bearer for a certain kind of centerish philosophy, which is really another way of saying, you know, a candidate who says, let's not throw everything we've accomplished out the window here. Let's make some changes, but let's not go crazy. How do you, that nothing of what I've just said is going to win any votes. So the question is, how do you build this in a way that resonates in people's hearts as much as some of these other messages do?
It's a huge challenge. So my answer is we have to appeal to an electorate that is informed, an electorate that cares about the future, an electorate that cares about a country that can progress, a country that can advance. And I think it's about being able to explain to people that the future can be very different. Based on those lessons that I put forward in my book, we can build a country that is a success story. We can build a country that leaves behind a lot of the problems of the past. We can build a country that we dream. We have to have the state delivering. We need the private sector involved with confidence, with strength. We need the private sector to invest. I'm very much someone who thinks that the driver in an economy is the private sector, their investment. So I think we have to appeal with pragmatism to the core values of the Colombians. And the core values of the Colombians are hard work. Colombia has never been an easy country. I mean, the terrain, the mountains, the topography here, we became an important oil producer, but everything in Colombia was hard. Producing coffee was very hard. Lots of effort. You have to sweat a lot to produce a pound of coffee. So, you know, that's the emotion, that's the sentiment, effort.
Mauricio, I want to ask you your opinion of the current president, Iván Duque. His approval rating is in the 20s. He's had a difficult time, like a lot of leaders during the pandemic. He's faced social unrest. On the other hand, the economic contraction was not as big as it otherwise might have been. And it seems like there has been some elasticity in terms of its ability to react in 2021. How would you grade his performance so far as his government draws to an end?
I think President Duque had a difficult situation to work with, which is the pandemic. And in that front, I would say he did a reasonable job. I mean, he was hands-on. You know, things could have been a lot better. We were very slow in getting the vaccines. We were badly hit by the pandemic. But I think he showed that he was very engaged and I guess close to the problem. My criticism comes from another front, which is I think he was trying to adopt the views early on of his party than his own. I think he's more of a centrist, but his party was pushing him towards more extreme views, more radical views. And it's in that context that he made some mistakes. I think, for example, endorsing the peace agreement early on would have been a lot better. It would have taken that issue out of the debate, which is what Colombia needed. But he, in order to kind of like please some of the members of his party, kept that debate on without much impact, and actually in a way that was detrimental for him, because you know, his chief peace agreement implementator has been doing a good job, but people perceived the government as a government that was against the peace agreement.
So Mauricio, moving on, as we look at the 2022 election through the broadest possible scope, putting on your hat as a political observer and someone who's been at the center of Colombian politics for many years, what are the stakes here? I mean, is it too much to say that democracy and capitalism themselves might be at risk in this vote?
I wouldn't say that. And maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I think the stakes are high anyway. We want change. That's central to this conversation, change. But we can easily opt for the form of change that is wrong. We can opt for a change that will essentially aggravate problems, that will make promises that are difficult to deliver, if not impossible. There are no easy solutions, Brian. This will require a lot of effort, and this will require also a lot of coalition building, forming kind of like majorities, trying to form consensus. So my fear is that a candidate that proposes the easy way out, that says, you know, things can be improved without effort, it's going to generate an expectation that will make people even more frustrated in 2 or 3 years. So my seeing of the elections next year is that we can opt for pragmatic solutions for governments that are able to form coalitions, to take decisions based on evidence, to learn from our history, or we can opt for something that is kind of like more radical and says, I have the easy solutions, but those solutions become, again, a source of frustration. So my fear is, what if we're entering a decade that will be lost, and in 10 years we'll look back and we say, you know what, the pandemic was disastrous, but the most important problem of the pandemic was the legacy of bad government, of bad decisions that were made after that.
I mentioned a candidate by name in the intro, and I think it's fair to talk about him specifically because he does place first in polls right now. You're talking about Gustavo Petro, I think, when you're talking about the populist in the race and so on. Is he as big a disruptor as he seems to be?
It's not just him, but certainly Gustavo Petro is very consistently ahead in the polls. And every single poll that has been made is showing that he has at least 30% of the electorate. So if he's 30%, who's got the remaining 70%? So I think it is the center and the right. How likely are these two groups to converge into a candidate? I think most people in Colombia are now very skeptical about that, because there are still very divisive issues. And those divisive issues are things of the past, such as the peace agreement. And I think that's wrong. That's what I've been telling audiences in Colombia. I think we should be thinking about the future, where people that have been divided on the peace issue can come together and say, look, this is what we need for the future. We need a country with better policies. We need a country with a government that is more effective. We need a country with less tax evasion. We need a country that overhauls government expenditures. You know, we need a type of reform that is associated with a new mental framework, not the discussions about whether the special jurisdiction for peace is good or bad. That is settled.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Mauricio, because I was struck this morning as we record this. The New York Times, or the international edition, had a story about Colombia's peace process on its front page. And I have to confess, my initial reaction to that was, still? We're still talking about this in the international press? Because I believe that the peace process was important. Yes, there have been problems with implementation. It matters. But when you talk to everyday Colombians outside of either the media space or Bogota, what tends to matter to them are these issues that we've been discussing so far in the program: healthcare, unemployment, and so on. And I often wonder if both Colombian media and the political class remain addicted to this subject of the peace process, which has, you know, created so much polarization and so much passion. It strikes me that so much of, well, or that at least that slice of the country has been unable to move on.
So there's a good reason for that, Brian. And it's that the extremes, as everywhere else in the world, benefit from strong emotions. Emotions of hatred and the emotions of anger. You know, groups also in Colombia try to exploit fear of going to communism. So the challenge for us, the more moderates, is to basically be able to explain that there is an alternative that may not be associated with emotions as strong as fear or hatred, but it's what really provides more benefits for people. It's what actually makes people live better. You know, we have to make sure that we bring out the emotions associated with that alternative.
Mauricio, I want to ask you two more questions before we go. One of them has to do, it is something you mentioned in the book, and it relates to climate change and Colombia's role in this debate. While you were finance minister, Colombia actually introduced a carbon tax, joining just 23 other countries in the world at that time. How do you evaluate where the country stands today in terms of balancing the fact that it's still an oil-producing economy, very dependent or somewhat dependent on oil revenues for tax collection, with what I really think is fair to say has been good leadership under multiple governments on the issue of climate change?
Colombia has announced that it will become a carbon-neutral economy by 2050, and that by 2030, the carbon emissions will be reduced by 51%. So those are very ambitious goals. And that, of course, generates a lot of support in international conferences and prestige. But I'm worried about the strategies. There's more ambition than strategy, especially as you pointed, in an economy that is still so dependent from oil, in terms of exports, in terms of revenues to the government. You know, there's a strong dependence there. So I think the new government in Colombia has to take a very pragmatic approach. How are we going to pay for that? Who's going to help us? What are the sources of income that will allow us to do that transition? So I think that conversation actually needs to take place. And that will bring us, I think, closer to the United States. I think there has to be a conversation with the Biden administration on, for example, issues such as the Amazon rainforest. I mean, the Amazon is being destroyed. It's becoming more of a source than a sink of carbon emissions. So we need to stop that. And that would be good for us. It would be good for the world as a whole. But to do that, we need money. We need resources. So I think that's an important conversation to have. Also, what are we going to do with oil? Are we going to, as the candidates from the left are proposing, stop exploration all of a sudden, or ban fracking actually in Colombia? Or should we do this in a more gradual way, where we use the resources from the oil sector to pay for the transition, to start paying, say, for the electrification of buses in our major cities? That's my view. I think we have to use oil while we have it smartly. We shouldn't be the first country in the world to stop producing oil, because then we'll be basically, we will be very poor, unable to do what is necessary to meet the targets that we have set, these ambitious targets in terms of emissions and in terms of becoming a net zero country by 2050. So I have a different take on and a more pragmatic take on the role of oil. I think we have to start reducing our dependency in a gradual way.
Mauricio, final question. It's another big one. Colombia has been less dependent on China than many of its neighbors in recent years. Prior to the pandemic, we were talking about $15 billion a year in bilateral trade. But that does seem to be changing. I mean, under the Duque administration, he, you know, despite, I suppose, being in many ways a pro-U.S. conservative leader, he has made state visit to China, has repeatedly solicited more investment and trade. This obviously has left Washington somewhat concerned, as it is about much of the region. In your mind, what is Colombia's best policy moving forwards in trying to balance its relationship with its traditional partner in Washington with this emerging superpower in Beijing?
Before I talk about China, let me say a word about the United States and this special relationship between Colombia and the United States. It has taken us to some mistakes, I think. For example, this announcement that the Duque administration was going to receive 4,000 Afghanis. I think that was that to me made no sense. We have no relationship with that problem. We have already a very difficult situation with Venezuelan migrants. But those are the things that Colombia does oftentimes to please Washington. And I think that's wrong. I think our relationship with Washington should be much more balanced. But Colombia seems very far away from China. When I speak with colleagues from the Americas about China, they seem to be much closer and much more in contact in trade, investment. That's not the case here in Colombia. And I think that has a reason, which is that the amount of foreign investment from China in Colombia is very limited. And the share of our exports that goes to China is also much, much smaller than other countries in Latin America. So it's a growing relationship, but it's not central, it's not considered at the same level as the U.S. So if we want to continue being strong ally of the United States, I think the United States should pay more attention to us. And also we should be more aggressive in looking for opportunities with China, including investment. So I think we have to balance our game a little bit more and make sure that our strong relationship with the United States is it really delivers more. I think Colombia, you'll understand this well, is a little bit taken for granted. And I don't think that's the right approach in Washington.
Mauricio, thank you so much for joining us on the AQ podcast. We covered a lot of ground across multiple continents. Always appreciate talking to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly podcast. You can read more at americasquarterly.org. Finally, if you enjoyed the episode, please give us a review, leave us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly podcast is produced by Brendan O'Boyle and Gabrielle Cohen. America's Quarterly is an independent, not-for-profit publication of America's Society and the Council of the Americas.